Welcome to this class, Classroom Theater. I'd ask you for the name Leroy Hirschberger, for what this guy's name is. I was at Reach in 2017, and he had a class on storytelling. I don't remember what the class was, but it was down in the sanctuary at this big building where the Reach thing happens. And what I remember is we came in the back, and the lights were turned down low, and there was someone down there on the stage. He's sitting on a bucket, and he has tennis balls, and he's juggling them. And he juggled those balls and juggled those balls. And he totally avoided this awkward silence that we just had while you're all coming in. Everyone's captivated watching. His mind is busy. He owned his stage. He owned his craft, what he was doing. I would like to think today about classroom theater or teaching as acting. And how can we teachers be better actors? How can we use the tools that actors use in our classroom as teachers? Gail Godwin says, and if you read the class description, you saw this, good teaching is 1/4 preparation and 3/4 theater. And I love that quote. I think it's very, very true. True to who I am. So I want to give a little disclaimer. If you want to be a different kind of teacher, God bless you. Be that kind of teacher. I found what works for me, and it's what I enjoy, and so I think it's what I should teach to you from. I'm going to do best at that. Teaching is like acting in several ways. How is your classroom a stage and you the actor? Your students come in, just as you're coming in right now, to watch me perform. Do something. Show something. Act something. And I hope that you're going to actually learn something. But you're observers. And what I am sharing with you, maybe I've rehearsed. I've walked up and down in the bedroom and said this speech many times. No, I didn't, but it would have been good if I would have. You've rehearsed it. You, as a teacher, have something. You've practiced, you're prepared, and your students are coming in, and the curtain rises. It's time for action, time to perform. Maybe you've taught for 10 years before now. You've taught and taught and taught many years, and you're just redoing the same old thing that you did last year and you did the year before. You get to practice that, and hopefully you can get it down to an art to where when that lesson starts, you can jump in and go, and you can tell them again and again and again. Students are observers. How does this comparison, analogy, whatever you want to call it, where does it fall short? I think a main place where classroom as a theater falls short is you need participation as a teacher. You've got to be asking your students questions. And when you go to watch a show, you're hopefully not participating in the action up front. That's up to the actors to do the acting. So a classroom is very much like a stage and an actor presenting before an audience, and yet not in this way, in that you need participation. So how can you make your classroom like a theater? How can we develop on this thought of classroom theater? First of all, show and don't tell. That's what a good actor is going to do. Classical education has been role model through the years. Role model as in, I do something, you watch me do it, and you copy. This is how children learn to do many things that they do. I role model it for you. This is what Jesus did. He sat down on the Sermon on the Mount, and he gave a lecture, sat the people in the grass, and gave a lecture. But then he spent the next 3 years role modeling what that looked like. That is really how he tried to teach. And we need to do the same. Education is not standing in front of a desk and giving a lecture. Education is not sitting behind a desk and checking papers. Education is role modeling. It's actually acting out the things you want your students to learn and do. Josephine just came in. The other day I cut my finger and it was bleeding a little bit. And someone in the house said, you should put a comfrey leaf around that thing. And we were fans of Claudia makes this wonderful comfrey salve and it heals a lot of stuff. But I got a little cut in my finger and it was bleeding and someone said, you should put a comfrey leaf on that thing. Well, 3 minutes later she came in the door with a little comfrey leaf. She said, here Tata, this is for your finger. You could spend all day showing someone pictures of comfrey leaves in a book. You could give a long lecture about what a comfrey leaf looks like. But she's followed her mother out and she's pulled comfrey leaves many times. And she knows now where to go in the weed patch, what a comfrey leaf looks like and what it's good for. And she can do it. She's learned well from role modeling. Are you okay with your students modeling you? I think this is a very serious question we need to ask as teachers. Am I okay with my students modeling me? For myself, I have a weakness in my teaching, and it came up, many weaknesses probably. One weakness, and that is I use the word shucks. Something goes a little wrong, like, oh, shucks. That's kind of been my thing, and I didn't really think it's not that bad of a word. It's, yeah, what does it mean? I don't know, but shucks, something went bad. And pretty soon, in the last couple of years, I suddenly started hearing my students saying it. And I was like, well, shucks, it's time to change this. It's time to quit using this word. It somehow sounds different coming out their mouth than it did for me. I can justify it, but I don't want them doing it. I think teachers need to look deep, deep in their souls and say, am I okay if my students role model me and do exactly what I do? Are you going to be satisfied if your students, when they're 30, are like you are when you're 30? Are you going to be happy about that? Now, don't think I'm saying let's be something puffed up and say everyone be like me, I'm something, I've got something to show to you. No, that's not what I'm saying. But your students are going to end up copying you, and they're going to be very much like you. I hope my students don't pick up on my weaknesses. I do know I can't help them much in the areas that I am weak. I have very little to offer them in those areas. I hope they don't pick up on my weaknesses. I can be reasonably sure they're going to turn out somewhat like me. They're going to follow me, and I need to be happy about that. So do look deep in your soul. If there are insecurities you have, figure out how you can deal with them. If there are weaknesses, try to find ways to fix them. You're going to, when you're showing, instead of just telling, you will definitely be followed. The classroom theater, shape your space. Take your stage and make it actually yours. The classroom is yours. Get in there and own it. Put stuff on the walls that you like, your stuff. Now, I'm not saying horseshoes and cowboy hats and that kind of stuff. If you're really into cowboys, go for it. But, no, don't. What I'm saying is, put stuff on the walls that is actually meaningful. My favorite verse is, "Thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven." And that is the verse that's on my classroom. It's been on my classroom almost all the years I've taught school. There's nothing that means more to me than that verse. So that verse is there. And if my students wonder, what's the verse doing there? That's a great opportunity for me to say, this is what this verse means. Own your classroom. The school I'm currently in, when I came there, it was an understanding that the lower grade teacher is responsible to do all the bulletin boards in the school. So the rest of the teachers get off free. Lower grade teacher does all the bulletin boards in the school. What does that do for me? I didn't put up this bulletin board. It's just one that someone else kindly stuck in here for me. It's not my theater. It's not my stage. I'm not owning this. Make sure that the stuff you put up is stuff you like and stuff that's actually going to reflect the values you hold. Some permanent and some changeable. Don't try to say, this is who I am. I like Volkswagens. It's not to show who you are, but it's to show the values that you love, the things you want to pass on to your students. And you must be comfortable in your space. Here's some things you can put in your classroom. Put lots of quotes. Quotes up, Bible verses, quotes. I think we need lots of Bible verses. Some things are permanent, like a scripture verse. Some things are changeable. 24 cards. You know the 24 game with math where you have four numbers and you can add, subtract, divide, or multiply and always get 24. Put a card up and change it every single day. This element Ken's joys, and I'm sure at other places as well. Put records on your walls. Speed drill records. How well you're doing in speed drill. Maybe attendance records. For many years, I had a record of how many days we've gone without any missed blanks or late work in our assignments. Do your bulletin boards. Put up student art. I heard this in another class already. Your students need to see the stuff they draw go on the board. And I'm just throwing a plug for art right here. I know it's not my subject, but I can't help. Articulations. Have you heard of this curriculum? Articulations. I believe that's the title of it. It is... I'm sharing the good news with you. Art has always been my worst subject, and I don't know how much time I spend on this, it's not my topic, but I've always dreaded it. Get articulations. It's expensive, $80, I think, for one booklet. I got the level 4 to 5, and I've been teaching it to my students now for just 1 year actually, but I'm only a quarter of the way through. There's daily lesson plans. There's everything laid out for you to do. And so we're doing drawings. We're doing abstract drawings. We're doing realistic ones. We're doing whatever the other one is called. And putting them on the wall together, one object, to draw in three different ways. The students love it. Yeah, they all punch each other and say theirs doesn't look good, but they actually do like it. Put your students' art on the wall. Science charts, parts of speech. I need parts of speech on my wall when I teach. Have a news corner, things that are everyday new information. These are ways that you need to decorate your space. You need to create it your space and be familiar with it. And then inhabit that space. Live in it. Be very, very comfortable with it. You shouldn't have to open three drawers until you find the stapler, or you're just not comfortable enough in your space. You shouldn't wonder, do we have any extra ping pongs here? You should know quickly. Inhabit your space, pray there and study there, and ask God to dwell there. Spend a lot of time before you even get started with school just sitting in your desk and thinking about the students, praying for them, praying for your new school year. We have a tradition at our school. Every Thursday I fast, and I fast for just dinner, for lunch. So the students know I won't be in the lunchroom, or I'll be in the lunchroom a little bit later, and they know I am in my room, and I'm praying for them. And if they want, they're very welcome. Just keep it. They're very welcome to come join me. They also know this. I think it does something. It does something for my space. It also does something for the students. Now, you're not supposed to fast before men, and yet sometimes you can't help but fast before men. And if I bring a sandwich along and I sit down in the lunchroom on Thursday, they're like, aren't you fasting today? Like, oh no, I forgot. I put the sandwich away or do whatever I'm going to do that day. But spend time in your room. Be Christopher Doc. I've got him on my wall. I want to be like this guy. I want to die praying for my students. I want to inhabit this space and bring God into this space, if he will. Inhabit the space. An actor inhabits the space in that he gets out of his own head. So we've got three things as an educator, three areas, one way of thinking of it. I have my brain. You have your brains. And then there's the space in between our brains. So my goal is to take information from my brain, throw it into the space between, and then you receive, and that information goes into your brain. This is maybe communication, as we've been hearing about. But you cannot possibly get into someone else's head. Some people claim they can, but it's very difficult to get into someone else's head. The best thing you can do is actually get out of your own head. At least get out of your own head. And this is where actors do very well. They forget who they are. That person they were before they came on the stage, probably they left outside the door. And when they entered that room, they're now in a different space. They're in the space of the act, in the space of the scene. And this way, you need to be in the space of the lesson. Study that 25%, that 1/4 of preparation is serious stuff. Do that 1/4 preparation so that you can totally get in that. Now, this follows the thought we said earlier. Be someone that your students can follow, and you're going to be happy about it at the end of the day. You can say, I'm glad my students are like me. But now leave that person behind and get out of that person's brain. Get out of who that person is and inhabit the lesson if you can. Inhabit the what you're trying to teach. Lose yourself entirely. Do not be afraid to be odd or silly. Of course, with limitations, we're going to get to that in a bit. But lose yourself entirely to the lesson. Lose yourself entirely to what you want to communicate. Don't be constantly thinking about who you are. I don't know if you've noticed or not, but my teeth are really crooked. It's not something I'm proud about. But we were poor folks growing up, and my parents couldn't afford braces for us. And plus, there were 11 of us. So complicated multiplication. But so my teeth are still crooked, and I'm a teacher, so I still don't have money for braces. I need to embrace that. I need to be happy about it and say, just look at my crooked teeth. I don't care. I'm going to do my thing. I'm going to be in the lesson. I'm not going to think about my odd personal characteristics, these things I wish were different about my body. Leave that behind and inhabit it. This is one good way of doing this is to just totally get into the lesson. Prepare until you're bursting, and then come out front. And then act. How do you act? Some ways of acting is play dumb. Ask questions you know the answers for, but just play dumb. You're the script writer. You know what you're going to talk about. You're the actor. You're out there on stage. But you're also the director. You're the guy who thought about this beforehand and decided, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to act a little bit surprised. It makes your class interesting. It will also teach your students well. Lester Showalter, in, I believe, 8th or 9th grade, I remember very much, my classmate, all of a sudden raised his hand and he said, I heard about an airplane that was made of magnesium, and the thing caught on fire, and they put water on it, and it just exploded. It made this huge explosion. And Lester Shore said, do you think that's right? He's like, seriously. He said, we've got some magnesium here. And he pulled it out, and he shaved some off, and he lit it on fire, and he took some water and threw it on there, and it made this huge explosion. He jumped back, and we all jumped back. I believe that was the first time he learned that. But I'm confident it's not. Not Lester Showalter. I mean, he wrote the science books. But for me sitting there listening to him teach, I was convinced. He had no idea this was going to do this. I think he was entirely acting. I think he was playing dumb. And for us, we remembered it a whole lot better because he didn't just say, yeah, that's what it would do. I could show you later sometime. Act. Have control. We said be silly, be willing to be a little nuts, but have control. When things go south, keep your cool. Don't show too much emotion. A good actor can control his lines, control his voice and his emotions very much. Stay calm when you're confronted, when there's bad circumstances going down. I just experienced one, actually. I was studying down here in the study. I don't want to shed any light on other people's children, but my two children were there playing, and I'm sitting in the study, and there's a little boy running around there, and I didn't know at the time who the boy was, but I suddenly saw that he's taking Josephine, and she can't even walk yet. Not Josephine, Lucia. He's taking her and pushing her head down into this cash register, and she's crying, and that's horrible behavior. So I grabbed my baby and held her, and she's soon happy, and I let her go a little bit long. I let her play again. I thought, well, this is odd, but it's probably just kiddish behavior, it's okay. And I went back to studying, and all of a sudden she's crying again, and out of the corner of my eye I'd seen this happen. She's there playing with this toy, he's off in the corner, he's watching her. Suddenly he goes over and grabs a doll baby, turns it upside down, and starts bonking her head with the head of this doll baby. And I don't know this kid from Adam. I said, why are you doing that to her? And he said, why do you do it to her? And my blood pressure is poof, right through the roof. Like, but he's just a kid. He's behaving like he should. And I'm the mature Christian that's starting to sin right now. Keep control. Keep control. I've had students will challenge you and make you mad. And if they haven't yet, they definitely will. I've got a really bad, really skilled set of students at this very thing. A boy this last year that was teasing another boy, and I said, first of all, he argued me, first of all, for a while, there on the playground before he wouldn't admit he was wrong at all. He argued me for a while, and finally I said, you go inside and take your seat. Well, he didn't want to, but he slowly went in the room. And I go in, and he's back looking at the books on the bookshelf. I'm sorry, when I say something one time, it needs to happen. And I've already told you 5 times to come in the room. Now to come in the room, you're sitting there looking at the bookshelves. A tip for you that I use for myself is I sit down right away. I sit down because I don't want to be standing because, first of all, I start getting nervous and shaking. But your emotions go up. Learn to control that. Students will make you mad. Don't show shock either. You'll hear scandalous things sometimes at school. But try not to show too much shock. Be surprised, but don't show shock. Don't force points you want to make with just passionate proclamations. I was sharing with some of you over lunchtime. Several weeks ago, I was teaching Bible school and shared a message about the head covering. And I'm really wound up about a few things on the head covering, so I won't talk more about that to you. But anyway, I was doing it really good because these are a lot of Baptists and Pentecostals, and they hardly wear the head covering and stuff. And so I thought they're pretty far on that side of things and everything's safe here. But I said I'm not going to talk about the size or the color or when to start wearing it, I mean, as soon as your child is born, or like at what point do you start covering the head? I said, I'm not getting into those things. We're sticking to the Bible here, and we stuck to the Bible until partway through, all of a sudden someone interrupted me, and they raised their hand and said, do you have to wear your head covering to bed? And they opened the trap for me, and I stepped my foot right in it. I said, well, an organization that requires, that dictates what its members wear to bed is a cult. And they all kind of laughed, and I kept on going. That's a huge mistake. One of the boys met me afterwards. He said, well, my friend stood up after church and said his church requires them to wear their head coverings to bed. And I suddenly realized this whole, many people here actually, that is their practice and that is their thing. So I had a lot of damage control to do the next day. Here's the thing. I believe the statement I'm making is true. It's very true that if an organization is dictating what you do in the bedroom, that organization may well be a cult. I think that this is, we could probably all agree this is a true statement. But does this actually relate to wearing a head covering to bed? Is that the appropriate statement to make when someone asks, should you wear a head covering to bed? No. There's a lot better ones that you could say. I mean, it's kind of like it's a true statement, but it didn't fit where it went. But instead, it came out this passionate thing. I should have had some more control. I told them the next day, my mother wears a head covering to bed and feels like you should, and I respect that. And if you do it, I respect that. And if your church requires it, I respect that. That's not the point. I said I wasn't going to get into the particulars because that's where we get all sticky and we have big disagreements. I wanted to stick with the same thing. I had another time when some students brought some things up in class, and they pushed me and pushed me. And for a long time, I've been kind of bothered by these students that they seem to me to be real interested in things of magic and things of superstition. And they finally pushed me too far the one day, and they're doing something. They say, what do you think about it? What do you think about it? And they said, Mr. Owen didn't like it. The last teacher, he didn't like it. What do you think about it? I should have said, well, why didn't Mr. Owen not like it? That would have been a safe course to take. Instead, I said, I'm concerned because it feels to me like you're just too interested in things of the occult. Again, it's a true statement. But those students instantly heard, you're accusing me of witchcraft. You're accusing me of being involved in the occult. It wasn't really what I was doing. But it's something that I bottled up for a long time. And when the moment came, I laid it out on the table. I should have used some control and chosen a better way to do it. Crying, being in tears in front of your students, there's a place for it. Again, use some control. I hardly can read any of the literature stories in the literature books anymore without tearing up. I don't know what's wrong with me. It's just getting old. They really move me anymore. I think it's okay to tear up a little bit and to cry, but control yourself. I don't think we have too much problem with that. With our emotions, that's a perfect place to show reserve and to not just inhabit the space. I think we can laugh, but end it after a while. Classroom theater, act. Actually get out and act. If you're trying to teach the students how to how molecules move, how sound moves, bumps molecule to molecule, line them up in a row and go bump and let them bump into the next one and bump into the next one and bump into the next one the whole way down the line. Get them involved. Jeff Swanson, when he's teaching dividing fractions, you grab the stand two students up and grab the second one and hold him by his feet. Turn the second fraction upside down when you're dividing fractions and then multiply. The student that's hanging there will remember. Reenact. Choose things. There's many things you can reenact. Things of history. Children love to act David and Goliath. They like to reenact and act out these stories. I think we need to make full use of this. Read a speech. Be Lincoln at Gettysburg and pull out the speech and just read it. Pour your heart into it. The Charge of the Light Brigade. Half a league, half a league, half a league onward, all in the valley of death, rode the 600. Forward the light brigade, charge for the guns, he said. Into the valley of death, rode the 600. Forward the light brigade. Was there a man dismayed? Not though the soldier knew someone had blundered. Theirs not to make reply, theirs not to reason why, theirs but to do and die. Into the valley of death, rode the 600. Cannon to right of them, cannon to left of them, cannon in front of them, volleyed and thundered, stormed at with shot and shell. Boldly they rode, and well into the jaws of death, into the mouth of hell, rode the 600. Flashed all their sabers bare, flashed as they turned in air, sabering the gunners there, charging an army, while all the world wondered, plunged in the battery smoke. Right through the line they broke, Cossack and Russian reeled from the saber stroke, shattered and sundered. Then they rode back, but not the 600. Cannon to right of them, cannon to left of them, cannon behind them, volleyed and thundered, stormed at with shot and shell, while horse and hero fell. They that had fought so well came through the jaws of death, back from the mouth of hell. All that was left of them, left of 600. Where can their glory fade? Oh, the wild charge they made. All the world wondered. Honor the charge they made. Honor the light brigade, noble 600. Few poems are done better than Alfred Lord Tennyson, but he tells you the story. During the Crimean War, an officer made a very serious mistake, and he sent a message that send in the light brigade, send in the soldiers that can go very quickly on horses, and these guys fight with sabers. And the reason why is that the Russians had overtaken some Turkish guns, and the British said, we can reclaim those guns. Let's get in there and slash at them as they're trying to take the guns back to their position, and they'll probably at least abandon the guns. If not, we'll kill them. But as the command came, there was miscommunication, and no one knows because the main officer was killed within the first minute of the fight. But instead, the light brigade were not set up for strong fighting. They're set up for fast fighting. They were sent right smack into the enemy's position was just advantageous. They had a long hill. They had clear sight. They just fired at these soldiers as they came riding in on the horses. And they died right and left. I think 213 of them came back out of there. It was they made it the whole way to the Russians. And then they came back. But it was a huge mistake, a huge failure. Go ahead and read the poem to your students. They'll remember it. And here's a song. Someone asked for a song. On the first day of January 1892, they opened Ellis Island and they let the people through. And the first to cross the threshold of that Isle of Hope and Tears was Annie Moore of Ireland, who's all of 15 years. Isle of Hope, Isle of Tears, Isle of Freedom, Isle of Fears. But it's not the isle you left behind, that Isle of Hunger, Isle of Pain, Isle you'll never see again. But the Isle of Home is always on your mind. In a little bag she carried all her past and history, and her dreams for the future in that land of liberty. And courage is your passport when your old world disappears. But there's no future in the past when you're 15 years. Isle of Hope, Isle of Tears, Isle of Freedom, Isle of Fears. But it's not the isle you left behind, that Isle of Hunger, Isle of Pain, Isle you'll never see again. But the Isle of Home is always on your mind. When they closed down Ellis Island in 1943, 17 million people had come there for sanctuary. And in springtime when I came there and stepped onto its piers, I thought of how it must have been when you're 15 years. Isle of Hope, Isle of Tears, Isle of Freedom, Isle of Fears. But it's not the isle you left behind, that Isle of Hunger, Isle of Pain,
isle you'll never see again, but the Isle of Home is always on your mind.
Don't be afraid to sing. If you can sing that song, your students will learn a lot. Use the voice God gave you. They'll learn to see Ellis Island through the eyes of an immigrant, I hope. They'll learn that Annie Moore was the first immigrant to immigrate to America. And she crossed that threshold, 15 years old, her and her younger brother. And they came from Ireland. Why from Ireland? Oh, what is this Isle of Hunger, Isle of Pain? The potato famine. Then you can talk about the conspiracy, the truth. You can talk about what happened, about the English making the potato blight happen there, if that's what they did. You can talk about, you now know Ellis Island opened in 1892 and that it closed down in 1943 and that 17 million people came through there. And your students might wonder, was Ellis Island the only place that people entered America? And why Ellis Island? And did everyone come through Ellis Island? There's just endless potential for actually knowledge and knowledge to be retained and more questions to be asked. If you're willing to, I think go ahead and just sing the song if you can. If you know any old ballads, they're the best. Those good old ballads. My favorite is Sun said my mother when I was knee high, you've need of clothes to cover you, but not a rag have I. There's nothing in the house to make a boy breeches, nor shears to cut a cloth with, nor thread to take stitches. There's nothing in the house but a loaf end of rye, and a harp with a woman's head no one will buy. And she began to cry. That was in the early fall, and when came the late fall, son, she said, the sight of you makes your mother's blood crawl. Little skinny shoulder blades sticking through your clothes, and where you'll get a jacket from, God above knows. It's lucky for me, lad, your daddy's in the ground and can't see the way I let his son go around. And she made a queer sound. That was in the late fall. And when the winter came, I'd not a pair of breeches nor a shirt to my name. I couldn't go to school or out of doors to play, and all the other little boys passed my way. Son, said my mother, come climb into my lap, and I'll chafe your little bones while you take a nap. And oh, but we were happy for half an hour or more, me with my long legs dangling on the floor, a rock, rock, rocking to a mother goose rhyme. Oh, but we were happy for half an hour's time. And now I forget. Men say the winter was bad that year. Fuel was scarce and food was dear. The wind with the wolf's head howled about our door, and we burned up the chairs and sat upon the floor. All that was left us was a chair we couldn't break, and the harp with the woman's head no one would take for song or pity's sake. The night before Christmas I cried with a cold. I cried myself to sleep like a two-year-old. But deep within the night I felt my mother rise and look down upon me with love in her eyes. Then there she was sitting on that one good chair, looking 19, on that one good chair with a harp. Ah! There she was sitting on that one good chair, looking 19 and not a day older, the harp with the woman's head leaned against her shoulder. Her thin fingers moving through the thin, tall strings were weaving wonderful things. And many bright threads from where I couldn't see came running through the harp strings rapidly. The gold thread whistling through my mother's hand, I saw the web grow and the pattern expand. She wove a child's jacket, and when it was done, she laid it on the floor and wove another one. She wove a pair of mittens, she wove a little blouse. She wove all night in the still, cold house. She sang as she worked, and the harp strings spoke. Her voice never faltered, and the thread never broke. And when I awoke, there sat my mother, with the harp against her shoulder, looking 19 and not a day older, a smile about her lips and a light about her head, and her hands on the harp strings, frozen dead. But piled up beside her and toppling to the skies were the clothes of a king's son, just my size. What does it mean? I have no idea. No, actually, I got an idea. Here's my idea. The mom could not offer the son, this is my interpretation, thought up within the last couple of days, the mom could not afford money for the child. She couldn't afford anything. What did she do? She had a harp with a woman said that she played. She had the little bit that she could. But the boy realizes his mom died but she made him clothes for a king's son. Was it actual clothes? Absolutely not. But what did she leave? She somehow left a legacy for him. She somehow had clothed him in king's clothes. And he said, I'm ready now to go on through life, remembering my mother, remembering what she could have and would have done for me, and I'm dressed like a king now. Just my size, made for me. That's beautiful. Use that. Learn a poem. Learn the book of James. Learn something. And then when your student's like, oh no, we've got to do memory work again this year. Oh no, it's not that hard. And be a teacher that actually knows some memory work. I've not done very well at actually memorizing what my students are at the same time they are. And especially now they're memorizing in Romanian, and it's very difficult for me to memorize in Romanian. Bible verses in Romanian, just they're very much beyond my reach at this point. But be able to tell them, you know how to memorize things. My sister told me when I was about 15 and I started memorizing things, Sons of My Mother, that's the same one, Papa's Letter. I was sitting in my study writing letters when I heard, please, dear Mama, Mary said that Mama mustn't be disturbed, but I was tired of the titty, want some other thing to do. Okay, this poem about Papa's Letter and poems teachers ask for. I started memorizing little poems. My sister said, you've got to memorize something big. I said, what is it? Well, the Ballad of the Harp Weaver. So that's a great poem to memorize. If you've actually put work into it, they'll be ready to put work into it too. Change the scene sometimes. I read about a teacher, a very good teacher, and he said that one time, it was a hot summer day, fall day, spring day, everyone was bored, and he jumped out through the window and taught his class in through the window. And he said, I didn't do it so much for their amusement as for mine. I was a little bit bored. I just jumped out and taught in through the window. Don't be afraid to change it up if it needs to be changed up. Maybe teach from the top of a desk. I don't think I've ever actually done that, but change your position. Be somewhere where the students can be interested in what you're doing. Use the element of surprise. Do what is unexpected. And I don't know what this could be for you, but I hope that as a teacher you've got a lot of tools that you're fitting in your toolbox. And over time you've got stories, you've got poems, you've got songs, and you've also have some other things. I was teaching again at Bible school, and I began to talk about one of my other pet peeves, which is gyms. I think it's horrible that young men nowadays think they have to have a subscription to CrossFit and these kind of places. This is my opinion. I take it or leave it. I'm beginning to sin by saying things too strongly. I don't agree with that lifestyle. My worry is that when you're going to the gym, you're actually learning more. You think you're just exercising your body, but no, you're actually having images and ideas put in your head about what a good human is. And it's actually not at all what a good human is. And I would suggest that a lot of the guys are going to... that's going to be another strong statement. I'll stop. But I am not against physical exercise. And in fact, I think that we all should learn to do things with our body, such as I can jump through my foot. I can hold this foot like this, and I can... Oh, let me try again. That happened the last time I did it, too. I can hold this foot and jump through. But that's not the end. I can then jump back. Don't be afraid to do something that's very unusual just in the moment. If you do that in front of a group of Bible school students, they're going to remember. I hope they actually remember the point as well. Now, classroom theater, exit well. When the curtain rises, when your school day is done and you step off that stage, leave it behind. Leave it all behind. Go home. Don't slip back into Mr. Hyde, but leave it behind. Shake off the weight of the work. That's what I'm talking about. The burden, that nasty problem you've been dealing with all day. Let it go at the door. Don't shake off the inspiration. Continue there. When I'm turning the compost pile and you see a big grub roll out, grab that thing and take it to school. The grubs are amazing. They're insects, right? Even though they're grubs. And you can see clearly head, thorax, abdomen. And how many pairs of legs are you going to find on them? Three, exactly three, on the little, the big grubs. And along the abdomen, there are those little breathing holes. And I took this grub into my class last year and said, hey, look at this grub, I found it. They're so cute too. When you lay them on the dirt, they turn over on their back and go head first down in, like on their back. But I took this grub and showed it to my students, and I forget right now the word, so I'm going to fail you on this. But one student said, "Those little holes are called," and he said, "Do any of you know what that's called, actually, those holes?" Spiracles, that's it. He said, "Those holes are called spiracles." I had no idea they were called spiracles. I said, "Are you sure? Like, let's look it up." "Yeah, we looked it up. Yeah, they're spiracles." Students will end up teaching you. Thank you very much. When you go home, shake off the weight of the work, but don't shake off the inspiration. Don't shake off the wonder that you see in the world. And then rejuvenate. Let the stage at school and go find yourself some rest. That ends my thoughts that I had to share. I'm going to turn this thing off.